All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio. This is Veterans Radio. And now, your host for today's program, Bob Gould.
Ah, yes. Good day to you folks, and welcome to Veterans Radio. We're broadcasting here from our station in beautiful Ann Arbor, Michigan. That's WAAM 1600 Talk Radio 1600. Dale is doing a little vacation day today. He's out of town, so I'm going to be sitting in here today. What do we got? Well, we're going to be talking about all kinds of Air Force stuff. That's right. And paratroopers. We got paratroopers. We got Air Force. We got airplanes. We got Russia. We got China. We got North Korea. We got everybody today. And Dr. Rebecca Grant will be on right after our first guest. So be sure and stay tuned. She's really got a lot of information. We got a lot to be talking about. But before we do that, we're going to talk about a couple things here. What do we have? We have the Michigan World War II Legacy Memorial, and it's going to have a special run. It's going to be called a Ruck, R-U-C-K, Ruck Run. Yeah, you can have a full pack, and you get to, well, you don't have to, but anyway, they're going to have a little something by carrying 22 pounds, okay? And it's going to be food, personal items, etc. And anyway, you're going to do that. It's going to be a bunch of fun, and that's going to be Saturday, November 11th. Oh, I believe that's Armed Forces Day, if I'm not mistaken. So Saturday, November 11th, the Veterans Day, Fun Rock 1 for the World War II Legacy Museum. So how do you find out more information about that? Go to the Michigan World War, that's MichiganWW2Memorial.org. Okay, that should be pretty cool. All right, what else we have? That's about, going out traveling. If you're going to be out and about in the next month or so, it's always nice to get out in the fall, right? You want to go out and see a lot of color in the trees, etc. Well, you want to go to Frankenmuth, Michigan, which is about halfway up north. And there's the Military and Space Heroes Museum. They have the largest display of Medals of Honor recipients. Also, a little something on Michigan's astronauts. That's in Frankenmuth, Michigan. And I'm looking here. Is there anything that they can give these folks? There we go. Okay, in Frankenmuth, it's once again Michigan's Military and Space Heroes Museum. Honor, respect, remember. You can find it. Google it. Michigan's Military and Space Heroes Museum. It's really neat, too. And they've got quite a bit. They've got, and their Medal of Honor section is really something. This is not your way back when museum. These guys have really done quite a job. Okay, we're going to go. We're not taking a break right now. Right, Derek? He's looking at me, shaking his head. And do we have our first guest? Oh, we do. We got everything. Our first guest, here we are, Dave Hamilton, Army paratrooper since 1987. And he's had jumps in under his belt. He works in the hospital at Fort Carson, Colorado, as a physician's assistant. He's also started and is administering the Round Canopy Parachuting Team USA. Okay, let's go right now. Dave Hamilton. Dave, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thanks a lot, Bob. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, I can't hear him, Derek.
Thanks a lot, Bob. I'm glad to be here.
I'm glad we got some communications. Well, and you're in mountain time right now, isn't that right?
Absolutely. It's nice sunny afternoon here.
Okay. You're with the Round Canopy Parachuting Team USA, and you want to help others get your knees back in the breeze. Keep your...
Yes, sir. So,
I got to read this again.
We have parachute operations. Actually, we have some starting on the 23rd of October, but we do air shows all over the country throughout the year. We have large number of airborne veterans that participate in our Round Canopy Parachuting Team. some from all over the world. We have veterans from England. We have veterans from France and Holland and Canada that come and jump with us to show all of the spectators at those air shows what it might have been like for paratroopers to drop in on their backyard.
Okay, well, right. That's a great introduction, but I still want to know if you are a airborne veteran, as I am, 101st Screaming Eagles. Hey, okay. 19...
Absolutely. Sky Soldiers, 173rd Airborne from Bamberg and Vicenza in Europe.
Oh, you guys had to get that in. All right. Okay, so for returning, now we're going to get into training. We're going to get into those of you who have not ever jumped from an airplane, exited from an airplane, at least not voluntarily, then you're going to want to go, gee, how's this thing work? So we'll get to that in a second. But get with Dave again. Well, here is get your knees back in the breeze. Where did you pick that up?
Well, that's one of the things airborne veterans talk about when they're getting ready to jump. Get your knees in the breeze when the airborne instructors are telling you how to get out of the door of the aircraft and have a vigorous exit into that wind stream of the aircraft so your parachute opens correctly. They say get your knees out into the breeze. And so that's something airborne veterans associate with, and we thought it was a great phrase to kind of get folks excited about jumping again when they may not have jumped for several years.
Well, I haven't jumped for 7 years, and, you know, I don't remember that particular little phrase. Of course, I don't remember a whole it's pretty exciting when you're up there, folks, and things are happening. There's a lot of noise, but, well, we won't go into that in a second. But I'm going to go right back to Dave. Dave, that you can help paratroopers who haven't jumped in a few years, and tell us about that.
So Jack Wingate was a Rakasan. I think you remember the term Rakasans from Fort Campbell and from Korea. He and Hubert Aachen from over in France needed to get a group of paratroopers together to help reenact the Normandy invasion on the 5th anniversary of D-Day. So they got a lot of their friends together that hadn't jumped in a while. They ran through some refresher courses in Donellan, Florida, and other drop zones in Florida. And then they got a team together to go over to participate in the 65th and the 70th anniversary of D-Day in 2014. So that was kind of the start of organization, and we realized that there were a lot of folks gotten out of it, hadn't jumped in a lot of years, that needed an avenue to go back and experience that airborne camaraderie again. It really helps with their resilience. A lot of these folks are combat veterans, have been through a lot of tough times, and sometimes they can only relate back to those people who have been through those times with them as a form of resilience. So we really try to build that into our team, as well as participate in these air shows and jump weeks like we're going to do here in a couple of weeks in Florida.
Okay. Now, so you're working with the veterans, which I am one, and quite frankly, quite to be honest with you, you don't forget that training. And as far as PLFs, I think I could do them in the dark with my eyes closed and my hands tied behind my back. I can do PLFs. I did about 3 million of them during jump school. So that's kind of second nature. I would think that when you get the veterans out there, that they're going to, within a few moments, just kind of pick up on it. Is that what you found?
Yeah, that's what we find. And, you know, because equipment has changed a little bit, some of the procedures have changed a little bit, some safety procedures have changed. We run through folks through a one-day refresher course. We talk about the new parachutes, the new equipment. We make sure that they remember how to do a PLF correctly. We give them guidance and corrections and make sure that they're going to do everything safely, because that's the biggest thing with parachuting. Any kind of airborne or aircraft operations, is safety is the number one thing. You can, you know, taking off is always voluntary, but, you know, landing is not. So we want to make sure that everybody's ready to go before they get back into that plane with a parachute on.
Okay.
And so that's the purpose of our one-day refresher. And that's very common throughout skydiving as well as paratroop operations. When someone's not jumped for more than 180 days, we run them through a refresher to make sure that they're still sharp. when they get into the aircraft and get their knees back in the breeze.
Yeah. Now, when you're doing this now, I'm sure that there is going to be. I mean, you mentioned safety. So, first of all, how many paratroopers that you have in a stick when they exit the airplane? How many actually go out at one time?
So we're usually working with about 12 to 15 paratroopers from the C-47 aircraft. It's the World War II aircraft that we use for our air shows and our demonstrations, and those are usually limited to about 12 to 15 paratroopers because that's about the size drop zone that we have. So we can only put the number of paratroopers out for the length of drop zone that we have, and that's about the size for most air show drop zones, is 12 to 15 paratroopers. But as you were there in Normandy or in Thunder over Michigan, we dropped more than 40 paratroopers all at the same time from six different aircraft. So sometimes we get a bunch of aircraft together and drop them all out at the same time.
Now, folks, if you're somebody, okay, you've seen this. You're at the air show a couple months ago here in Ypsilanti, and you saw this. Oh, man, I'd really like to do this. And you get the wife's permission, whatever, and you go ahead and you decide to do this. You've never done this before. You've been up in airplanes, but they've been commercial, and here you are. So take us through what's step one.
Well, step one would be to contact us from our website. It's rcptusa.org, and you can find us on Facebook as well. But our website has got all the information on how to join, how to get started with a basic airborne course. Our basic airborne course is 3 days long. We do a day of ground school and PLFs and teach all the things that you need to know to exit that aircraft safely, as well as go through three practice jumps so that you know how we know how you're going to perform in the air, and we can give you tips on each one of those jumps. And then you're able to jump with us in our weekend air operations from World War II aircraft, helicopters, whatever aircraft that we can have available.
Now, okay, so I've gone through, now, when you do these jump schools, are they at the same dates or just before an air show?
So we tried to time them so that we can get people qualified to jump in Normandy. So we'll do an air show, we'll do a training in March, and then jump in Market Garden. So we'll do potentially a training in somewhere around, I think, July or August, and then usually we do jump week in October. So we try to have, you know, two or three of these jump schools a year to make sure that if people really want to go and jump in Normandy, we can give them the training and the experience so that they can do that safely.
So once again, folks, that's RC, R as in Robert, C as in Charles, P as in Peter, T as in Tom, USA. rcptusa.org, okay, that's right. Did I get that right?
That's absolutely correct.
Okay, .org, and that'll give you lots of more information. But and it says here our courses are in Palatka, Florida, okay, October and March. And, oh, I see, so you have current jump masters and retired. So now, okay, so I do this. Does anybody wash out?
So we work with folks to get past the challenges that they're having in the jump school. I mean, this is not like the Army Airborne course, which is 3 weeks of, you know, running 5 or 10 or 15 miles a day and doing a million push-ups every day and rolling around in a sawdust pit. We try to make sure that people are fit and safe before they come, and then we work with them on any of their challenges. We have not had anyone that has washed out of our program because we have the latitude to work with them until we teach them safety.
Do you give them a physical first?
So we ask them to bring a statement from their primary care physician or provider to say that they are safe to perform parachute operations. And we have a list of the things that we need them to be able to be fit for. So, you know, the standard, if they can see well, if they can hear well, if they have the flexibility and movement of their joints. Because the last thing we want to do is to have someone put themselves or the other jumpers or jump masters in jeopardy because of their health status.
Now, I'll tell you one thing, folks. That's one thing to see them in the air. It's another thing when you're up in the air, and I remember that day. I'm sure you do too, Dave, that very first one. They were C-119s, flying boxcars. Oh, boy. Yeah. Oh, man. That was a beautiful, beautiful airplane. It was so contemporary. It was so utilitarian. It was very pedestrian, as folks like to say today. That's right. And that was a C-119. What did you make your first jump out of?
I did my first jump out of a C-130, and that's the same aircraft that they're using today. So that can hold 64 troopers on a one-way trip. And that's one of the airborne cadences that we sing when we're doing our 5 miles of running every day for airborne school. But it's got two doors, so paratroopers can exit out of a door on each side, and so they can put 64 paratroopers out in one pass if you have a big enough drop zone for that.
Well, I did a C-130, but we didn't use the doors. We went right off the tailgate. I'm sure you've done that.
Absolutely. That's another way to jump the C-130, and that's a very – that's a very enjoyable jump. I'm sure that you experienced the same thing. You liked that jump pretty much better than any other jump that you've done.
You know, folks, it was so cool. You're stepping off. There is no breeze. You're stepping off into this abyss, right? You're looking down, and there, I don't know, 2,000 feet, whatever, something like that. So you just step off. And then, of course, then the wind hits you, and et cetera. But it's really, really, really neat. And anyway, the C-119, so I had five jumps. And right after that, we went right from there and got our wings within moments after landing. And within about an hour after that, we were given our assignments. And I was assigned right there, the 101st Airborne Division. How about you, Dave? Where did you first get sent?
So I was in the reserves at that time, and I was in the 11th Special Forces Group. So as soon as I finished airborne school, I went back to my unit in Columbus, Ohio, and then we did a jump within about a week after I got out of airborne school. So that's kind of the nice jump. You do your first jump out of airborne school with your unit, and they all kind of, you know, make sure that you are as safe as the unit wants you to be. So that was a great experience for me as well. And then I got to go to Jump Master School shortly thereafter. After I had about 15 jumps, I was able to go to Jump Master School in Fort Devens, Massachusetts, with 10th Special Forces Group.
Now, if people ask paratroopers and folks like yourself, why do you do that out of a perfectly good airplane? Well, I'll tell you why, because where else are you going to be able to have that kind of experience? Hmm? When I went, and by the way, it's an all-volunteer outfit, right, the whole airborne, including the cooks. The cooks actually jump. They'd come in their whites, get a parachute, come out with us, and by 11 o'clock, they had already parachuted. They're back to cooking. And the whole atmosphere of airborne, they actually had have you been to Fort Campbell, Dave?
Absolutely. I was stationed there for 4 years in the 5th Special Forces Group.
Well, then you know where the Yamamoto drop zone was. And that
absolutely.
That was right next to the mess hall. So in the afternoon, or for lunchtime, folks, there would be a parachute drop, usually at 11 o'clock, 11:30, and there we all are. We had big, one whole wall was all windows, and here comes the three airplanes are coming out, and here come the paratroopers. Everybody cheers, and boy, it was a way of bonding. We bonded that way, and there it was, and it was there with you every single day. And we even broke starch. That means get on a clean pair of clothes, fatigues. We broke starch in the field. How about that, Dave?
Absolutely. You roll up your starch. You probably had those starch jungle fatigues, and we had starch jungle fatigues and BDUs. And you just kind of put your leg into those things, and you hear that as it, and a nice sharp crease you could almost cut yourself with.
Now, somebody's got to pack this thing. Okay, somebody's got to put it, and you put a lot of trust into that person, I'm sure, right? We all do. In fact, there was even a little booklet. This thing wasn't, more than 2 inches, maybe by 2 inches, a small little booklet that the rigger would sign in and put the initials, his initials, and the date, of course, the parachute was packed. So I mean, there's quite a bit of trust there. But in your organization, who packs the chutes?
So we do have some riggers, some current Army riggers that are authorized to pack our main parachutes and our reserves. But for the most part, the members pack their own main parachutes. Now, a rigger has to pack the reserve because it's packed a very special way, so it opens very quickly. And that's common throughout skydiving and parachuting, that the certified rigger must pack the reserve. But our members pull our parachutes out, stretch them out, get them just right, and then fold them and pack them into their own packs themselves. And the first parachute that I packed, because I was always dependent on the Army riggers. In the Army, the riggers pack the parachutes. But the first round parachute that I packed was in Normandy, France, getting ready for our jump into the La Fiere drop zone for the 70th anniversary of Normandy. And I tell you what, I was a little apprehensive when I jumped that first pack job, but it opened fine, and I had no twists in my lines, and you know, I had a great jump for that day.
And that's it, folks. There's nothing like that feeling when you look up and the thing opened. Oh, boy, here we go. And you know what I remember, everybody, is how quiet it was up there. The first thing on my first jump, the chute opened, and I looked around, and how quiet. They call it the silence of canopy flight. Tell us about that, Dave. Hello, Dave. We lost
you. When you load the plane, it's running. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still there. We lost you there.
And the plane's loud, it's running. You're getting ready to jump. The doors are open. The wind is blowing in. It's really, really loud. You jump out. Your parachute opens, and it's just flat. And you look at your parachute, make sure that everything's set, and then you look around to see where the other jumpers are so that you don't run into them, and you can steer away if you're close to them. And then you just, you know, up for 3 to 4 minutes, you're looking around, and it's just the most silent flight that you've ever heard in your life.
Oh, amen. And it's like, it said, well, what's the landing like? It's like jumping off the top of a garage, the roof of a garage. Okay. Yeah. That's about what it feels like. And you do the training well, folks, but as far as PLFs, the first couple times, I don't think I did anything right. I was tumbling, rolling, and trying to keep everything together, because you're so excited, which you just did. Because when you hit that stream, when you're going out that door, you hit that stream at about 120 knots, 130 knots. Tell us about that, Dave.
Well, we have a special exit procedure where we vigorously exit the aircraft, so we clear the bad air that's close to the aircraft skin, and you jump out and have real tight body position so that you're not flopping around in that wind stream, and that gets your body in the right position for your parachute to open correctly. And so you try to jump out toward the tip of the wing on a C-47. You're not going to make it that far, but that will get you far enough out into that great air that's right behind the propeller, so that your parachute opens great.
Okay, so here I am. I'm a new person. My parachute is open. This is my first jump. And everybody, is there going to be somebody down there to talk me into the landing, or am I pretty much on my own?
So for folks that have paratrooped before, we are just down there watching them, and we'll guide them down if they need it. But they usually have the muscle memory to land, you know, fine. But just like with skydiving instruction, for the first couple of jumps with a static line skydiving rig, we'll put a radio on you so that you can hear radio instructions on which way to turn and then what time to prepare to land to do your PLF. Because with our parachutes, we really always want to be landing with the parachute aiming into the wind, so the wind is blowing in your face. And that's the best way to land these parachutes. So we want to make sure that new jumper understands what it's like to turn into the wind and is looking at the wind sock so that they turn into the blowing wind so that they decrease their forward speed so they have a nice soft landing.
Now, folks, if you're brand new at this and you're thinking, gosh, what's this thing is going to be? Well, you know, there is this feeling of accomplishment afterwards, and the feeling of camaraderie. Camaraderie. You've done something that not every Army person, Navy person, Air Force, whatever. You've done something very extraordinary in your life, and you've shared the same techniques, the same training that they have since even before World War II. So if you want to get involved in this, you want to go to RCPTUSA.org, and that'll give you lots of information. Dave, you've got the final word here. Why don't you tell us a little something about what you'd like to say to everybody?
Well, the real reason that our founders started this organization was to honor the valor of airborne paratroopers and all veterans throughout the world. If you think about in the 1940s, the airborne was a new concept. And so the Germans used it first, the Russians started picking up on it, and then the Americans said, wow, we better get on board. So we accomplished several very successful and some unsuccessful airborne operations in the European theater and in Africa to give ourselves, to give the Allies an advantage.
Okay.
All of these, all this organization to really honor the power of all of those paratroopers and veterans throughout the world.
Well, Dave, that's our band, and they're getting up to signal that our break is coming up. I want to thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio.
Thank you very much, Bob. I really appreciate the opportunity.
And we will have you back. Thank you again. Wow. That was really something, huh? Well, anyway, if you want to go to our website, veteransradio.net, and feel free to contact us, okay? We'll put you in touch with whatever. And 10 seconds, 8, 7, there we go. We'll be right back with Dr. Rebecca Grant. Don't go away. You're listening to Talk Radio 1600. Thank you. The band got that one out, too. And we want, well, that's the Air Force theme, of course, and that's going to be Veterans Radio welcoming our frequent guest and who gives up a portion of her Sundays when she's on. By the way, we're live, folks, so she's giving up a portion of her Sundays to give us a ton of information. And any of the things that we talk about today, folks, are apolitical. Nobody here is making any statements against any political, whatever, who's ever team. We're not doing that. We're here to just present information because a lot of things aren't getting out. They're out there, but they're just not getting dissected and getting out to the public. So we're here at Veterans Radio. We always are looking for truth, and that's what we got right here. So Veterans Radio would like to have a big welcome for Dr. Rebecca Grant. Dr. Rebecca Grant is the president of IRIS Research. That's IRIS Research, which is a think tank, essentially, for the U.S. Air Force. And Dr. Grant has been on our program many times, and a lot of folks were telling me today that they were waiting and anticipating for her appearance today. So let's give a big... That's right, WAM Veterans Radio. Hello to Dr. Rebecca Grant. Hello.
Hey, Bob. It's good to be with you again.
Ah, boy, there's so much going on. It's almost like, where do you start? We're going to be concentrating a lot on North Korea, China, and Russia, and we're going to just try and put all this into a little bit more of a perspective. So when we're starting here and we're looking at North Korea, I guess my first question is there used to be something called the triad, which was the Air Force, the Army, and the Navy. Is that still in existence?
Yes, the triad is very much in existence. It's the that is our strategic deterrent. And the triad, Bob, as you know, it consists of Air Force bombers, the B-52, and the B-2 stealth bomber. That's one part of the triad. The other leg of the triad are the Minuteman nuclear missiles, which are based here in the United States, of course. And the third leg are our submarines, which can also launch nuclear missiles, and we don't know where they are. So they roam the seas of the world on their specific missions. And the idea behind the triad, it came out of the Cold War to deter the Soviet Union and now Russia. And the triad is, it guarantees that no adversary can ever take out all of our nuclear weapons. And that's the cornerstone of deterrence, very much in operation today.
Well, okay. So now, we have, but the response for the Air Force, I mean, does the Air Force still have bombers in the air 24 hours a day?
No, they have bombers that are on alert, so they can be launched very, very quickly on warning, just in a matter of minutes, with nuclear weapons, should they be commanded to by the president and the chain of command.
So the Dr. Strangelove fail-safe is really no longer a situation.
That's right. You remember that movie so well. And it turned out that there were a lot of accidents with bombers back in the 1960s and the days of Chrome Dome and all this and trying to keep that airborne. So it was President George H.W. Bush back in 1991, I believe, who took them off of that immediate alert. But make no mistake, these fellows, whether they're at Whiteman Air Force Base, the B-2s, or the B-52 wings, one up in Minot, North Dakota, the other one down at Barksdale in Louisiana, they are all ready to go very, very quickly. So they're still ready.
Okay, so we've got this response. We have the Air Force portion of the response, and now we segue right into North Korea. Is the Air Force the primary response? Militarily, is it the Air Force, or what do you see?
Well, North Korea is such a complicated problem, and the response with North Korea is a little bit different. So, first of all, when you hear the administration talking in general terms about military options, rest assured, the first thing they're thinking of is conventional military options. So, the strategic triad is about nuclear weapons. The administration has looked over a lot of options for conventional, non-nuclear attack. And yes, Bob, you're 100% right. The bombers are on the leading edge of that. In fact, we have bombers that rotate through Guam out in the Pacific. Right now, I think we have 6 B-1s from the squadron at Ellsworth, Rapid City, South Dakota. They are manning that rotation now. They're ready to go with conventional strikes that, because they're very precise, can be very devastating. Now, don't forget, too, we have 28,000 U.S. servicemen, Army and Air Force, permanently stationed in South Korea. Then there's the Navy, of course, 7th Fleet, and that can be augmented in the Pacific. So there's a lot of potential military response that's there. Beyond that, you know, the other piece that's very, very important that we don't talk about a lot is our missile defense system. There is a missile defense system that works in theater, as we say, you know, that's the lingo. So for the shorter range missiles that North Korea has, if they were to launch against Japan or against targets in South Korea, a key element of that is THAAD, theater high altitude air defense. South Korea just added about 6 THAAD batteries. And they are a great kind of catcher's mitt missile defense system, very sophisticated radar, now operational in South Korea. And then, you know, here at home, we've known for a long time that North Korea or Iran or someone could develop a few intercontinental missiles, maybe with nuclear warheads. So our planners saw that coming and started some years ago to put in place the ground-based mid-course interceptor. And that system operates out of Alaska, and it's actually manned by the Army. They watch very closely, and they are the ones who will launch if there is an inbound intercontinental missile coming towards us. We think they're not quite there yet, but we've had that defense system in place in Alaska at Fort Greely. We have almost 40 interceptors there in silos, And there's an additional site down in California on the Central Coast at Vandenberg Air Force Base, where they have an additional 4 interceptors in the ground-based mid-course system. So that's a lot of words and a lot of lingo, but what it means is that for the first time in dealing with North Korea, we really do have a good layered missile defense in place. So if they make the mistake of sending a missile our way, the commander of North American, of NORTHCOM, who is an Air Force general, her name is Lori Robinson, and she says, if it flies, it dies.
I
can't
guess.
Beat that, can you?
Okay, but all right. Now, I'm good. And again, folks, we have to jump around here because there's so much going on in Korea and with all the players. And I want to say this, and I want you to comment on it. This is my thoughts, I've thought a lot about this, that China, first of all, deep down, China's our friend. It always has been. Okay, yeah, we have our disagreements, whatever that, but for the most, that's something that we can count on. We can count on China more than we can count on Russia, number one. Number two, I don't believe, and I want you to comment on this, Dr. Grant, that China really wants to stay on the sidelines while we bomb North Korea. I mean, they got to be, and that's another Asian country. They'll take care of it themselves. Don't you feel that that's the situation?
No one wants to bomb North Korea. Now, we will if we have to, right? There are a lot of options, though, that fall short of that. And, you know, the administration, they keep saying, and it's really worth repeating, they want the diplomacy to work. They want the economic sanctions to work. But, Bob, to your point about China, excellent. You know, I saw a Gallup poll one time that said that about 58% of Chinese citizens think America is a really cool place. So they do like us, I think, deep down. Now, China is becoming a big world power. They want their sphere of influence. We have some issues with them. But when it comes to North Korea, we do have a strong mutual interest in keeping the lid on that situation. And I really see this ending at the negotiating table. China has been very helpful. They did one incredibly important thing a few weeks ago, and that was they said to North Korea, if you start military action, we will not help you.
Wow.
And it basically cut them loose. They actually haven't done anything since then. I mean, knock on wood, right? Because, you know, they could do anything. But they actually haven't done anything super provocative since China said that. So, you know, what we see here is that we are working with China. I think the president has tried very hard to work with China's leader, Xi Jinping. China can't live with this North Korea either. They've become too much of a threat, and China can't be the kind of global power that China wants to be with crazy North Korea on their border. So they want a solution as much as we do.
Now, okay, and I'm going to remember that, and I'm going to say that a lot, that China actually has already made that very clear. And that's very important, folks, that we know that there now is negotiations besides all this saber-rattling and all this bellicose. It reminds me of a bunch of kids out there on the playground yelling back and forth and waving their fist. Well, that's not going to be the situation. Who else is involved in those negotiations?
Right. Russia is involved. Japan is involved. And, of course, South Korea. So the way I like to see it, Bob, with China is it is good cop, bad cop. Trump is being bad cop. China is trying to be good cop behind the scenes. Russia, Putin has been pretty active. He's been over to talk with the South Koreans. Russia has some economic interest there in doing some gas field development and pipelines and all sorts of things. So he, too, is wanting this to get to negotiations. Back about 10 years ago, the last big North Korean crisis was solved by what they called the six-party talks, and it was the U.S., China, Japan, South Korea, Russia, and, of course, North Korea. So as soon as North Korea is willing to show up to the table, I think we'll see that kick in again. Of course, South Korea, I've been very impressed with the South Koreans. They have held firm. They have beefed up their missile defenses. They have beefed up some of their military, and we're about to go into a period of routine naval exercises between the U.S. and South Korea. And their diplomats have been super. They've said, look, bring it on. We are going to hold firm. We'll launch an operation if we have to. So they've been very resolute. And, of course, they face this. It's right across the border for them. But they've been very, very resolute. Japan, too, has been 100% in favor of keeping the military pressure on to try to drive North Korea towards the goal of denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula.
We're going to stop right there, folks, and take a very quick break for a couple of PSAs. Everybody, Dr. Grant, go have yourself a sip of water. Everyone else, take just about a one-minute break. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk Radio 1600 WAAM. Okay, you're back on Veterans Radio, right here on Talk Radio 1600 WAAM in beautiful Ann Arbor, Michigan. I'm talking with Dr. Rebecca Grant. We're talking all about North Korea, Russia, China, the UN. Did I leave anybody out? No. Well, here's, should we arm Japan to where they are on their own, where they don't need us, and we can get the heck out of there and away from that? What do you think?
Well, Japan has a pretty good military. You know, they call them the Japan Self-Defense Force. There are a lot of restrictions there in their constitution that prevent Japan from deploying those forces around the world. But they are super. I mean, they have a top-line air force. Their navy is excellent, and we have for many years shared operations between the U.S. Navy and Japan's Maritime Self-Defense Force, where they have cruisers and destroyers that are ballistic missile defense ships. And either a U.S. ship or a Japanese ship is always on station to guard against a threat from North Korea. So we've been doing that together for a long time. You know, the way that military operations work today, Bob, is everybody wants to be with allies. So it's not a matter of saying, hey, you know, you've got good aircraft and a well-trained force, go do it yourself. It really, everything works better together. So any military options that we contemplate, are always going to be with allies. Interesting note in that, too, is we've seen a lot of strong support from Britain, from the United Kingdom. Of course, they are a UN Security Council member, so they've been very important in the North Korea diplomacy. But Britain's defense minister said a couple of weeks ago, he said, some of those missiles from North Korea that they are starting to test, they can reach London. And you look at the globe, it's an over-the-pole shot, right, over the North Pole. So the threat from North Korea's expanding technology really unites all of our allies. North Korea just went off on Australia. They launched all this fiery rhetoric, and the Australians need to stop meddling. And, you know, so really this just brings our allies closer together. And that's what we want to see. Any actions that we take there, whether they are just a deterrent show of force, that's going to be done with allies. And heaven forbid if there are, you know, if there really is military conflict, guarantee we'll set it up on our terms, not on North Korea's, and we'll be working with our allies.
Okay, so now, all right, so we're still going to be protecting, quote-unquote, Japan. Is there any other reason that we need, with all these missiles and bombers and things, why do we need that presence in that part of Asia?
Well, it goes back to, like you say, to our treaty commitments. We do have bilateral treaty commitments. But, really, to take the long view here, we're trying to do two really important things. One is trying to stop North Korea where they are now. It's very scary, but it's still 1960s technology. It's ballistic missiles, very small numbers, potential nuclear warheads. It's terrible, but if we were to let this go 10 years, you and I would be talking about cruise missiles, which are harder to target, and about maybe hypersonic reentry vehicles that North Korea could either develop or go out and purchase these weapons. So we need to get this stopped now while we still have an overmatch in our missile defense technology. We can handle it. This is the right time. The other thing that's going on here is really, it's kind of historic. And, you know, the U.S., with our allies, is for the first time trying to prevent two nations from becoming full-fledged nuclear powers. And, of course, that's North Korea and Iran. We've never done this before. When India and Pakistan acquired nuclear weapons many years ago, we said, well, okay, that's terrible, but they'll deter each other. It's too late now. There's nothing to be done. We tacitly acknowledge they're in the nuclear club. In this case of Iran and North Korea, the U.S. and our allies, we are really trying to stop them from becoming nuclear powers because of the types of nations that they are. You know, Iran, sponsor of terrorism, North Korea, we know all about what they're like. So it's really the first time in world history that we've tried to stop two states from acquiring a nuclear weapons arsenal.
Kim Jong-un, what does he want to get out of this?
Oh, I wish we knew. Actually, we do kind of know. He wants to be a nuclear power, right? He also wants to keep control of North Korea in his family dynasty. And now, Bob, this was before our time, but Kim's grandfather, of course, set all this up. And you may remember a couple of gentlemen called Mao Zedong.
Oh, yeah.
And Nikita Khrushchev.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turns out they had a meeting in the 1950s, and one of the subjects was what to do about North Korea. This was just a few years after the Korean War ended. And even Mao and Khrushchev could not figure this one out. They just decided that they would let that kingdom just be the hermit kingdom, and they, you know, let it go. And we can't anymore, of course, because of the developments in technology. So, you know, the ace in the hole here still is that China does have a huge leverage over North Korea. They control almost 90% of their trade. They run their internet. They have the border there. So there is still a big lever there, and there's still some sanctions we can put in place. There are a lot of military options that fall far short of all-out war. There's a lot more that can be done. And what Kim wants, you know, and he's just going to have to be persuaded that he is not going to become a nuclear power state. We just cannot accept that.
Wow. That's really something. Well, is he... I'm thinking of his own, Kim Jong-un's own administration. Is he safe with them right now? Is he solid? What do you think about that?
Boy, I wish we knew. You know, he's running the last Stalinist country on the face of the earth. So they had their kind of big, North Korean political party jamboree a few weeks ago. He promoted his sister. Who knew he had a sister? Well, he does. He promoted his sister into a more important job. So I think he's trying to secure his rule. But, you know, everybody kind of hopes that there are people within the North Korean elite who understand that he's taking a dangerous course. We don't have a lot of insight. I hope our intelligence agencies do, but we don't have a lot of insight here on that one. You know, what we do know is that this is so technical, but it's important, that the round of sanctions that the UN put in place last month went specifically after, the bank accounts of some of the top North Koreans, the ways that they trade and exchange foreign currency. So they are gradually tightening the screws on Kim's ability to give good things to his cronies. And that could really begin to make a difference.
Well, do they have any Western goods at all over there? Or who's supplying them with food? Who's supplying them with technology?
Right. You know, they do trade with China and with Russia. And don't forget, there's smuggling that goes on, of course. You know, and the Cubans were caught a few years ago running weapons, like guns mostly, not high-tech stuff, but running weapons into North Korea. There are also a lot of North Koreans who work abroad and send currency back, and they're trying to clamp down on that. Russia has closed off. It has a tiny little border with North Korea, and they sent some more soldiers and some German shepherds up there to make sure that border is closed. So everybody's trying to squeeze, you know, the textile exports and the last little pieces to really try to convince Kim to come to the negotiating table.
Well, folks, and Dr. Grant, I'm going to state this. I don't care what anybody says, but it's going to be, and if we settle all this and there's no nuclear exchange and they don't become a nuclear power, they're going to want to do something in this world. And where's the first place to start, right? Manufacturing, really cheap labor. But I cannot see Americans, especially American servicemen, ever buying anything. I mean, right now, you can look at a shirt made in Vietnam. Well, I wonder, are we ever going to be able to say that made in North Korea? I don't think so. What's your thoughts?
Oh, I don't know. It's too hard to say. Hopefully not. But look at that another way. Right now, we're using the sticks, diplomacy, sanctions, aircraft carriers, bomber flights. At some point, we will get started with the carrots, whatever those are, to try to sweeten the settlement at some point. So, you know, who knows what that'll achieve down the line. But right now, the best thing we can do is try to keep the military pressure on and keep that back-channel diplomacy with China working hard.
Now, everything, folks, depends on great data. That's what I'm trying to say. Great data coming. Do we get that from spies or do we get that from monitoring their radio signals?
All of the above, I think. And don't forget, lots of surveillance planes. I have no doubt that every last resource of our intelligence community and that of our allies, and of course the South Koreans too, are very, very, very closely watching what's going on. Lots of aircraft, ships, you know, you name it, satellites, and good old human sources, as they used to say. I think they're all watching North Korea very closely.
Okay, give us a timeline. How quick do you think all this is going to get settled or something's going to happen?
History shows us it takes about 8 to 10 months. We are about 6 to 7 months into it. So I think we may have another few months to go of keeping the military pressure on. I would expect possibly a few more rounds of sanctions from the UN, maybe another missile shot here or there, some more force posturing, and I would hope within 2 to 3 months we'll start to see some positive movement.
Okay, you mentioned something here that talking about our men and women ready to, quote, fight tonight, unquote. I'd like you to go over that, and you've got the last word. So take some time. Go ahead.
Well, that's for the forces, our American forces with their families, who are stationed in South Korea, 28,000 U.S. servicemen. That's Army and Air Force ready there defending that border alongside the South Koreans, Republic of Korea Army. And their slogan is, ready to fight tonight. The other thing they say informally is, hey, this is getting real. So that shows that that's always been on a knife edge there. Those are our most ready forces. They fly a lot. They train a lot. They do their ground maneuver exercises. And we really owe those servicemen and women a debt of thanks for being ready to fight tonight on the Korean Peninsula. They are the first line of deterrence, and my hat is off to them.
How much time, Derek? We got 1 minute. Okay, you're on the Fox channel or what? What channels? I don't think anybody. What stations are you on right now?
Yeah, you can catch me on Fox Business, especially Making Money with Charles Payne, sometimes on Fox News, and I've done a couple Fox and Friends segments as well, usually talking about North Korea and Iran. I love to get the military facts out to my fellow Americans.
Well, when do you think you could come back and give us an update? What do you feel is wow, what should we do this, a month from now or what?
Yeah, let's do it in another month. Anytime, Bob. I love being on with you.
Okay, well, we love having you. Thank you again, Dr. Grant. Thank you again for your family, for giving up a Sunday. And from everybody here at Veterans Radio, and Derek and Dale and myself, well, we want to wish each and every one of you having a great day. So until next week, you are dismissed.